You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Oink.
And Evan Bernstein.
It's funny you oinked, Jay, because on this date, April 30th, 1878, Louis Pasteur lectured at the French Academy of Science in support of his germ theory of disease, in which he held that many diseases were caused by tiny organisms.
Bugs. Oh,
wow, that was a seminal event.
Yeah, where's the germ theory now?
Yeah. Talking about flash in a pan. That
what
came
a
and
fad.
Went fast. Ugh. That'll never stick.
Could you imagine being the person who came up with the germ theory? That's just so tremendous. It's amazing.
I wonder, did he come up with that completely, utterly on his own, or were there a few people before him that kind of were like, you know, around the fringes of the idea, and he just kind of put it all together? That happens a lot.
Well, I mean, the notion of a contagion and infectious diseases, that some diseases can be transmitted through some, you know, tiny things existed for hundreds of years before Pasteur. The idea that there are microscopic organisms was discovered before Pasteur. And others like Semmelweis were already advocating hand washing as a means of decreasing the transmission of infectious disease. So Pasteur had all the elements already in place: microorganisms, infectious agents, antiseptic technique to avoid infection. But he kind of put it all together.
But there hasn't been anything about germs in the news lately.
No. So you can't turn on any news outlet this week without hearing about the swine flu.
Oh, man.
Jay, what do they call the swine flu in Germany?
Oh, Schwein flu.
I thought they just called it a porkalypse.
Porkalypse? Oh, my God, that's great.
Ooh, that's good. I like it.
We have our resident infectious disease expert, Mark Crislip from QuackCast, on the show later to talk all about that. But first, we're going to talk about some other news.
Mark is awesome.
He's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
First, Bob, you're going to tell us about these crazy scientists shooting lasers through the Earth.
Yeah, this was pretty cool.
Crazy.
I remember when I was a kid, would you guys do this? You'd shine a flashlight into the sky. I used to imagine the light kind of like maybe hitting the moon or traveling through space for a really long time.
Yeah, I did it a week ago, Bob, that one.
Oh, well.
I still do it on a foggy night, see how far a
light. The light doesn't actually even get out of the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, right. And years later, of course, I realized, well, that was pretty silly because the atmosphere, it's a sponge. For light, for such a feeble light source, the atmosphere just soaks that stuff right up. You know, between diffraction and absorption and other interactions, not one photon probably even gets out of the atmosphere. But now, apparently, from this news item, maybe I was right when I was a kid. I don't know. This is pretty weird. Andreas Ringwald and his colleagues at the German Electron Synchrotron in Hamburg, they claim that with the right preparation, you could actually shine a flashlight or, I guess, a laser at the ground, and some photons may actually come out of the other side of the planet. So, of course, this has caused about a million websites that now say that photons may be used to send secret emails through the Earth. I don't know. They picked up on that email through the Earth idea and just ran with it. It's all over the place. But these aren't ordinary photons, as you might imagine. They're called hidden photons because they, I guess, they hide pretty well. Actually,
it's brilliant, Bob.
They didn't pull these photons out of their butts. This supersymmetry. Thank goodness. Supersymmetry actually predicts hidden photons. Have you guys heard of supersymmetry?
I do not know supersymmetry.
I never liked this theory.
You didn't like it? It just won the Nobel Prize. Well, it didn't. The people who developed important parts of the theory just won the Nobel Prize.
I believe that the Nobel Prize we were talking about, though, for this year in physics was for exceptions to symmetry, right? How symmetry gets broken, which is necessary for cosmology, you know, for the whole universe.
Yeah, situation. I think this is different, though. Supersymmetry is a specific case. I think it's a little different than just plain old symmetry in nature. Supersymmetry is a hypothesis that there's a symmetry between bosons and fermions. Rebecca, stop it. I can hear your eyes glazing over. Believe me, this does get a little more interesting.
That's right.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It just seemed somewhat disinterested when we talk particle physics.
Well, the last time we discussed symmetry, I was one of the only ones who knew what was going on. So,
oh, okay. Okay, so then you will really enjoy this.
Oh, my God.
All elementary particles are either bosons or fermions, depending on their spin. Bosons are force carriers, like photons, which mediate the electromagnetic interaction. Fermions are basically matter particles, electrons, protons. Those are prime examples of that. So supersymmetry. Supersymmetry says that each particle, each of these force carriers and matter particles, have a super partner. Each force particle, therefore, has a super partner that's a matter particle, and vice versa. The matter particles have super partners that are force carriers. So you got that? So a graviton has a gravitino, and an electron has what they call selectron. And this is one of the problems I have with supersymmetry. The naming convention stinks. Selectrons.
Bob, what about Megatron?
Yeah, even that would be better.
Megatrino.
There you go. But the other problem is that in one stroke, this hypothesis doubles the amount of all known particles. Don't we have enough of these particles? They got to just double them. Like, oh, just multiply by two.
X2.
And you're angry about this, Bob?
It's just annoying.
And Bob, is this based in some kind of mathematical situation? Does this make does this help the math work, or is this just a bold supposition?
No, actually, from a couple websites I went to, they actually said that string theory actually predicts this, and other sites describe this as an extension of the standard theory. So there is definitely some mathematics behind this, and it does make some predictions, but still, you know, there's no evidence. There's no evidence at all yet that clearly indicates that these super partners actually exist. But like a lot of these hypotheses, if they're true, it could lead to unifying the fundamental forces of nature, something I've been waiting for a long time, still waiting, and figuring out what the hell dark matter is. That would be nice. Mm-hmm. I think I would actually like the theory if it told me what dark matter was. So, all right, so if these hidden photons exist, they need to have two important attributes. One is that they have a tiny mass, and the second is that they're essentially invisible because they would not interact with any charged particles in ordinary matter. So that means that if these things really have these attributes, then they can just fly through the densest material like it was nothing, like the entire diameter of the Earth. So in this way, they're like neutrinos that stars create. They're uncharged and have very, very little mass, and they can zip through literally light years of lead like it was a vacuum. So they're very similar to neutrinos in that regard. So then how do you detect them? How do you know if these are invisible? How do you even detect these so that you can read your email that's coming from China? It's believed that they oscillate between a normal photon and a hidden photon. So they kind of jump back and forth between these two states, which is yet another striking similarity with neutrinos, because neutrinos do the same thing. There's different flavors of neutrino, and as the neutrino is coming from the sun to the Earth, they oscillate into other flavors of neutrino, which actually explained one of the big problem we had with neutrinos is there wasn't enough coming from the sun. The standard theory said that we should be getting X amount of neutrinos, and we weren't seeing X. And one way they resolved that problem was that the neutrinos actually oscillated between the different flavors.
Bob, I have a funny aside on that point before we get off.
Go ahead.
A number of years ago, I was arguing online with some anonymous young Earth creationist, right? And they actually put the argument to me that the solar neutrino problem, which is what it was called, was actually evidence that the entire nuclear hypothesis of stellar physics was wrong.
Okay.
That the sun was only, 10,000 years old, and that it was heated by its contraction, not any nuclear reactions going on in its core, because there weren't enough of the neutrinos detected as is predicted by the standard model. So
that's like a God of the Gaps almost.
yeah, it was. My two main points back to him: well, if that's true, why are there any neutrinos? You know, wouldn't you have a harder time explaining why there are any neutrinos coming from the sun versus not as many as we predict? And plus, even at that time, this was years before this was confirmed, there was already the hypothesis that the neutrinos were switching states, and we were only detecting part of them because they were changing flavors en route, and that was later confirmed
by the Kemi-Okande telescope.
And, you know, Steve, that's funny because what you just said reminds me of a conversation I had with a friend of mine. And he said,
you know, I have one simple request, and that is to have sharks with frickin' laser beams attached to their heads.
This was a friend of yours?
Yeah, I recorded our conversation. He didn't know about it.
That's illegal.
Interesting.
Did he have knowledge of your recording?
He does now.
All right.
Well, wow. You were saying, Bob.
Back to the interesting stuff here.
So just like neutrinos can flip between one state and another, they say that these
hidden photons can
oscillate between hidden and normal photons.
So here's what you have. So here's how you would get your email through the Earth. You encode the information onto a laser beam. You shine the laser beam at the ground. Some photons will oscillate into hidden photons and then sail through the 8,000-mile diameter of the Earth. Some of these would then exit the ground, say, in China, and then oscillate back into photons, which then we would have instruments lined up precisely at the right spot and read the encoded message. Bam. So there's your email through the Earth.
But if you go straight through the Earth from here, it doesn't end up in China. It ends up somewhere in the Indian Ocean.
Well, it depends, I guess, how you aim it. You could aim it pretty much to go through any part of the Earth that you want. So wherever you're aiming it is where it's going to come out. So is this even possible? What are some other scientists saying? Well, physicist Doug Shaw at Queen Mary University of London says that it would be technically challenging to line up transmitters and receivers over these large distances, but he agrees that it seems feasible in principle. And it's a nice idea, he said. Unlike most hypothetical particles that are only accessible at high energies, these particles, if they exist, would have potentially useful real-world applications. And that's true. A lot of times you read about Higgs bosons and all these esoteric particles, and they only appear at high energies, and people react. They say, "Well, that's fine, but how is this going to really benefit me in the short term?" This really could have a real-world application that everybody could see. And the other applications would be interesting. Eavesdropping would be impossible unless you were right in the line of sight of the beam. And we know how cybersecurity is these days. That would be definitely something our cybersecurity professionals and are looking into these days.
Bob, that wouldn't be – it's not like a radio signal that it could be very widespread or it could be picked up by an infinite number of
– No, you would have to be literally in the exact line. There's no way to pick it up otherwise.
The ones that you're picking up, I assume they would have to oscillate from a photon to a hidden photon between the beam and the surface of the Earth.
Right.
And then they would have to – then there'd be those subset of those that happen to oscillate back
exactly
after it leaves the Earth, but before it reaches the detector,
right?
And and is there a calculation as to like what percentage of photons would actually oscillate?
Yes, I meant to include that in my notes here, but there was one scientist saying that the data rate, the transfer rate, would be very, very small. It would take a tremendously long time to to communicate. Say one MP3 would take a tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
If it works, if you're going to communicate a lot of information, it might not be practical, or you might need a huge facility to transfer a practical amount of information over a reasonable period of time. Or you just have to deal with, yes-no answer type things, quickie little responses.
So you're saying that pretty much the only practical application of this would be sending small secret messages back and forth?
Possibly, unless they can – maybe they could build a huge facility to transfer lots of information quickly. I don't know. But, yeah, that's more likely. We'll see that first, little bits of information.
Bob, if they build this rig and test this and it works, would that be the first experimental confirmation of supersymmetry?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not aware of any other research that points to supersymmetry really well. I mean, apparently there's some indirect evidence, nothing really solid, nothing really super clear. So if they could actually prove this, I think that would be, it sounds like it would be one of the best results for supersymmetry and also, I guess, string theory, because from what I understand, string theory had a hand in actually, making these predictions, these supersymmetrical predictions itself. So maybe they would also be a leg up for string theory, which is, as we all know, for the longest time, it's one of the biggest problems is, it seems almost unfalsifiable, at least for now in the short term.
The next news item I want to talk about is a recent fossil discovery of yet another missing link quote-unquote missing link, this one in the evolution of pinnipeds, which are seals, sea lions, and walruses.
Walruses.
I think, well, someone will correct us on that.
Steve, entry. Also, it's Steve, walruses. I don't think they found a link. I think they created two more gaps.
Yeah. Of course,
maybe
that's
just walrus, the
standard joke that's now a cliche.
Yeah. Had to throw that in there.
Yeah. So this fossil is about 20 to 24 million years old, and it is dubbed Puigila darwini, and it is a walking seal, right? It's kind of like a seal, but it has legs that are more adapted to walking on land, although there's the fossils indicate that the digits were likely webbed, so it already was somewhat adapted to swimming in the water. And it was a carnivore, which, you know, the ancestors of pinnipeds are carnivores. So it's actually a very nice transitional fossil. Before this fossil, so this is interesting because pinnipeds were one of those branches where the oldest examples of pinniped ancestors that we had were already fully adapted to aquatic life. So there weren't any transitional fossils from terrestrial to aquatic life. In fact, the oldest fossil in this line is about 20 to 28 million years old and, again, already had fully formed flippers. So this is an important piece to the puzzle. It also suggests this is found in the Arctic, which may indicate that that's where the pinnipeds evolved, although, again, this one fossil is not enough to establish that. It's just a suggestion. You know, you always like to think, what do the creationists make about this? You know, each new transitional fossil, something that is filling a major gap, you know, like between land-based animals and pinnipeds, certainly puts a huge crimp in their arguments. You know, they behold the position that there are no transitional fossils. Well, here's yet another one. They come out on a regular basis. But they have a few strategies that they use to deny the implications of this. Right? So, like, you can imagine about this fossil what they would say. This is 20 million years old, but we already have a 28 million year old fossil that has fully formed flippers. So clearly, this species was not an ancestor to the older species that already had fully formed flippers. And that's true. This was not a direct ancestor because of the dating, right? This is 20 million years ago, and 28 million years ago, they were already more developed along the pinniped line.
And of course, that's just a fancier way to say if humans came from monkeys, then why are there still monkeys?
Right.
Understanding that this fossil represents a cousin of the other pinnipeds that we've discovered.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the right. That's exactly the right answer. Is that they're thinking again because they don't understand evolution, right? They never really studied it from primary sources usually. They have very simplistic misconceptions about evolution. It's not a direct linear progression. You know, we say, evolution's a complex bush. And you're almost guaranteed to be digging up fossils that are coming from some side branch, not the one tenuous line that happened to lead to existing species, right? There's nothing special about the species that are alive today. You know, that's not the direction that evolution was going in. It just, we only know in retrospect that this was the direction that one branch was headed in because they're around today. But pinnipeds or birds or horses or whatever, any of these families, these groups are radiating in multiple directions. And if you find examples of them at random, you're almost guaranteed to find one on a branch other than the one that led to the few surviving species. So that's what we have here. But what it shows is what kind of morphology there was at this time. And another good example would be, say, Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx is, you know, half dinosaur, half bird. It's probably not a direct ancestor to modern birds, right? But who cares? It shows you at around that time, there were things that were half dinosaur and half bird. And since Archaeopteryx, we've discovered many now fossil, many feathered dinosaurs. Again, not representing a linear sequence from dinosaurs to birds, but representing this bushy radiation of feathered dinosaurs, one branch of which led to birds. This is one piece to this complex picture. evolution predicted that we would find a piece that looked something like this, and it predicts that we'll find more. We did for whale evolution, we did for bird evolution, and now, you know, now
bad evolution.
We're starting to fill in the gaps in bad evolution. We talked about turtle evolution recently on a recent show, and now pinniped evolution. It just keeps happening. You know, the predictions made by evolution are being validated. The next news item is about NASA. Not massa, but NASA.
Not massa.
See, fly.
See, moon.
In congressional testimony, Acting Administrator Chris Scalise testified to the House Committee on Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees space, that he indicated that he is open to putting more emphasis on human missions to destinations like Mars or a near-Earth asteroid instead of the moon.
Well, aren't the two connected?
Like, well, not literally.
It depends.
Well, I mean,
we have to build a space elevator for that.
We've spoken about the plausibility of needing something on the moon to act as a jumping-off point to get to the planets, right?
That is certainly one school of thought, one that I find very compelling. That if we develop an Earth-to-moon infrastructure, have a permanent base or presence on the moon, that the moon can become a launching pad to the rest of the solar system. The moon has a couple of big advantages. One is that it's got a lot of raw materials that we wouldn't have to bring there. And two is that it's already significantly out of the gravity well of Earth, and it doesn't have nearly the gravity that Earth does, so it's a lot easier to launch rockets from the surface of the moon than the surface of the Earth. Therefore, a lot of scientists, I know that Isaac Asimov, for example, is a huge advocate of this, for example, of putting our short-term emphasis on fleshing out an Earth-Moon, you know, infrastructure so that we can get to the moon and that we have permanent presence on the moon, and then using that to go to the rest of the solar system. But if we go to Mars, that's likely to be a one-off where we go, you know, again, the flags and footprints, right? You plant your flags and footprints. We do some stuff. Maybe it's interesting. Maybe we get some good science done. And then we leave and it's done and we haven't really gotten anywhere. We haven't accomplished anything permanent. It's just a one-off mission.
Yeah, plus for me, the big elephant in the room with a lot of these articles I was reading was the fact that the problem with the cosmic radiation during the long flight to the many months it would take to get there, the cosmic radiation, from what I could tell, is a deal killer until they could really find a way around it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we recently had a discussion with
Seth Shostak.
Was it Seth who said that maybe it's not quite as bad as we anticipated? But I hope they're at least thinking about that, because we're not going anywhere until they really resolve that. I just think the moon is a great first step, and not only to build the infrastructure, but the learning process. You know, you make a mistake on the moon, you're only a couple days away from rescue. You make a mistake on Mars, and you're game over. You're done. So there's so much that we can learn on the moon first before going to Mars.
Yeah, NASA has a website where on the NASA website they discuss the reasons to go to the moon, and they actually polled a lot of scientists and engineers, et cetera, and compiled the compelling reasons to go to the moon. They outlined the major themes. One is that it's an extension of human civilization, which I think is very important. Two would be scientific knowledge, you know, the history of the solar system and the Earth. Bob, what you just mentioned, exploration preparation, we'll learn a lot about going places by going to the moon rather than, you know, trying to go to Mars first off, which is going to be much more technologically difficult. We can use it to form global partnerships, which I know is a big theme that Carl Sagan was in favor of. It will represent economic expansion. It will engage the public in a very high-profile, cool science and technology endeavor, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of good reasons to go to the moon and to do it first before we go to Mars. Some people were speculating that this may be a signal from NASA that, you know, they're not going to really have the funding, bottom line, to get to the moon by 2020, which is what they were hoping to do, and that this is a way of spinning it. But at the bottom, what they're really saying is we're not going to make it to the moon because we don't have the funding. But, you know, who knows if that's really the case.
Jay, do you like the moon?
I like the moon!
You know, I have one thing to say about this. This is one of those deals where it just seems really obvious that we should be using the moon as a base for further exploration in space. And I think not funding it, like, why would we fund anything before we would fund that? I still don't get it. I don't understand the rationale behind that.
You mean within NASA?
Yeah.
Well, NASA does a lot more than manned space exploration. This goes back to that old debate that we have about science versus exploration, robot versus manned. You know, there's legitimate points you made on all sides.
Well, you know, at this point, though, it seems more likely that a private company is going to put a base on the moon for you know, like a hotel or, you know, go for a couple of days type of deal.
That'd be nice.
Well, yeah. I think low Earth orbit will be first before private companies go to the moon.
Well, and there are I see the first, Jay, private company going to the moon is going to be a company that wants to mine its natural resources.
Speaking of which, when we were interviewing Seth Shostak, he made the comment that there's a lot of bauxite on the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
And it turns out that that's not true. A listener, Kalen Bentley, emailed us to say that there is no bauxite on the moon, although there is aluminum. And I checked it out, and he is correct. There's a lot of aluminum, but it's in a different form than bauxite. Bauxite is a sedimentary mineral. Rocks need to be weathered in order for it to sort of consolidate into bauxite. And we mine that because it has a high concentration of aluminum. However, there's no bauxite on the moon because there's no weather, but it does exist on the moon as anorthite, which contains a lot of aluminum as well. There's some anorthite in the Earth's crust, but there's probably a lot more on the moon, and we can sort of develop techniques to mine it on Earth and then apply that to the moon. So minor correction.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Did you know that there was a mysterious figure spotted?
There is.
Guys,
tell us about it.
There's really not much to say. It's one of the absolute shortest and worst articles I've ever seen written about pretty much any topic ever.
You need to get out more, Jay.
Wow.
What's that? No,
you need to get
it's
out
about, it's more about specific. A paragraph. It's asking you to not believe in it, but here it is. Ready? A mysterious figure was spotted by an Arab expatriate lady in Oryx. In the Middle East, a country called Qatar, you know, she supposedly spotted like this little humanoid type creature that has a really weird looking left hand, has super buggy eyes, spiked up hair. And upon first glance of the picture, the first thing you notice is that the eyes have to be fake.
Could it be Marty Feldman?
It's not a fake picture, though.
Yeah.
It's not. It's not a fake picture. I know exactly what it is.
What, is that a statue that somebody made?
No, it's a small action figure. It's a toy. It's a little rubbery alien doll.
Wait, I could buy one of those?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I have to own that.
What happens when you pull the string? What does it say?
It's like one of those, it's like a stretchy thing. You remember like Stretch Armstrong? It's kind of like that, just a stretchy toy. There's a forum called iloveqatar.net. Someone on the forum figured it out, apparently. At least that's the first place I saw it busted. They have before and after pictures. There's like the picture was like the it kind of looks like the contrast was heightened in the picture, but that's pretty much it. Otherwise it looks exactly like the little toy.
It's just a rubber doll.
Uh-huh.
Wait, so those are the actual eyes on the doll?
Yeah. Creepy little eyes.
So they look freaky just because they're like white, rubbery bug eyes.
Yeah, and with the contrast bumped up, it makes the eyes pop a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, they pop the eyes.
Oh, wait. I just looked at the website. It is. It's a... oh, my God. This thing is awesome. I have to own one of those.
Now, wait. According to the article, the woman was very soon surrounded by a large number of people who also attested to the fact what she had seen. But suddenly, it disappeared out of their sight when they tried to go near it. Any comments
I'm
on
guessing
that part of the report?
Scam.
Yeah, my first guess is that she lied.
People never lie in science.
This isn't science. This is real life.
Oh, you're right. Science fiction. People never lie in science fiction.
Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. We have one email from John Wilson in Chicago. And John writes...
Chicago.
Hey guys, really like this week's show. Your discussion of Saturn's moons prompted me to search for pictures when I stumbled upon this gem, a website claiming Iapetus's ridge must be man-made. Thought you might like a good chuckle. Have you guys had a chance to see this website?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
So you know who this is coming from?
Oh, yeah. That's Hoagland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Richard Hoagland. Yeah.
That's his new face on Mars.
Hoagland!
I love it.
He's a classic nut job. He thinks that everything is a big NASA conspiracy. For some reason, he's fixated on tetrahedrons. I guess he thinks that that's somehow part of the alien technology and that NASA's in on it. So his most famous debacle, I think, was the face on Mars.
Face on Mars, yeah,
claimed that the face on Mars was an alien artifact. Then, of course, when his enemy is always higher resolution pictures. Yeah. Got a higher resolution picture, and it was clearly just, a natural mesa formation. So he said, a little bit of special pleading. Oh, NASA took all the data and then dropped a nuclear bomb to destroy the face on Mars.
That's just a little bit of special
pleading. That's one of the best special pleadings I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. It is a good one. NASA dropped a nuclear bomb. I didn't even know they had a nuclear bomb.
So now he has an entire site dedicated to the notion that Iapetus, the moon of Saturn, that's light on one side, dark on the other side, that has this ridge around its equator that we talked about, I think, last week, that means that the Iapetus was manufactured by aliens. There you go.
Yeah. Oh, it's like they made that's the seam of the mold or something, Steve?
Yes. But it's really laughable. So one of Hoagland's favorite tactics is to zoom way in on low-res pictures and then look for pixelation artifact and declare it to be, again, that needs anomaly hunting, right? In fact, I wrote an article about anomaly hunting using this as him as an example. He's anomaly hunting, but sometimes the anomalies are just pixelation artifact. One thing he did, he looked at the very edge of...
Yeah.
Of between the light and dark area, the lit area of the moon, of Iapetus. Yeah. And there are pixels floating above the ground, right? So, and he thinks that's because there's literally stuff floating above the ground.
Like ships or...
Whatever.
I'd like to see somebody do a whole website of things like that where you just zoom all the way into just a regular photo until it's all pixelated and then find something and, just draw things out like out of regular photographs. And I bet you could make a just as compelling a case for like a face on your aunt's birthday cake or something. I think that'd be fun. That's my challenge to the listeners. Do that. Someone do that.
Like an anomaly hunting website for skeptics?
Yeah. Yeah.
He zooms into one of these pictures so far. He zooms in so far that you actually can see the color distortion where, do you know when you make a color, you can make a color like the way a pixel works on a screen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like where a pixel is actually three different lights that combined, it's an RGB group that makes the color, right? Pretty much it. You could actually see that when you in one of his pictures. He's zooming in that far.
Yeah. Yeah, Hoagland, I think, didn't he claim recently that he found all these funky, weird letters in Google Maps? If you zoom in real, real close, it says no data here or something.
I see what you did there.
Oh, my gosh.
All over the planet. If you zoom in real close, it's got words.
Oh, Bob. God, that is so stupid.
That's about the level of it, though. To finish what I was saying before, though, is that that's just a lighting artifact, right? So the stuff floating above the ground is just the mountain peaks that are just across the light-dark line, right? It's like the light shining off of the mountain.
Yeah, that's probably the most likely explanation.
Or it's pure pixelation artifact.
Right.
It's one or the other.
Right.
But it certainly isn't stuff floating above the ground. But he is just incredible. But he's also tireless. I mean, he is a classic crank in that he has something that passes for intelligence, although he also has some major malfunction as well. And he...
what is your major malfunction?
He puts a tremendous amount of energy into this. He has a lot of factoids at his disposal. So if you try to engage with him, he's just pulling stuff out of his butt left and right. But he just can't put it together in a coherent fashion. He's dedicated to this notion that there are alien artifacts in our solar system. And he will, again, twist facts and do whatever he has to make that argument. So it's a sad in a way, but at the same time, it's a good example of the process that pseudoscientists go through in order to defend their claims, such as the anomaly hunting that he does. And the final thing that I noted about this website that John is linking to is that Hoagland has a lot of the low-res pictures of Iapetus.
But none of the high-res ones.
Right, from Voyager or some of the earlier Cassini pictures, but none of the close-up high-res Cassini pictures of Iapetus that show it, where in which it looks like an obvious natural formation, nothing artificial or constructed. Strangely missing from this website.
Yeah, but Steve, NASA went out there with rakes and shovels, and they leveled off all of the geodesic things he's talking about. I mean,
well, I think we're running out of time, so let's go on with the interview. Joining me now is Dr. Mark Krislip. Mark, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Hey, Mark.
How you doing?
Good.
And Mark is an infectious disease specialist. He is the producer and host of the wildly popular Quackcast podcast, and also a contributor to Science-Based Medicine. And he's joining us again tonight to talk about the swine flu, because everyone else is talking about it. We might as well talk about it, too. So, Mark, get us up to speed. Tell us about the swine flu.
Well, this appears to be a new strain of flu that started evidently in pigs in Mexico. And the first cases were in Mexico, and now it's spread to both the United States and to other countries in the world. And it appears to be, and unfortunately there's a lack of good information because it's all coming in fresh, but it appears to be a new strain. It sounds like a bad transporter accident, but a pig flu, a bird flu, and a human flu all combined to give us a new flu.
In a pig.
Or maybe it's like, yeah, in a pig, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
That's what flu does. And it's kind of like, I guess, more like the movie The Fly. And so we have this new version of a flu that's picked up a bunch of genetic code from different strains of flu, and no one has any immunity. It's called in the biz, we call that the genetic shift that influenza does periodically. And whenever there's a shift like this, you worry about a pandemic. And some of those pandemics have been disastrous in the past.
So this is a genuine threat.
It could be. I mean, it's hard to tell because there's so few cases, and the information coming out, you can't really tell what they're dying of and what the infectivity is. This could potentially recapitulate 1919, or it may fizzle out like 1976. So we're not going to know till either it sweeps the world or it goes away.
So Mark, is there any chance that this could evolve or mutate into something that makes people into zombies?
That's always my hope. Because I'm always looking forward to the zombie apocalypse, and I'm going to take refuge at the local Costco. Don't tell anybody. And so I'm prepared. I read World War Z, so I'm ready.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we all read it.
Jay,
we love it.
Jay, you bastard. I prepared a question just like that, and I think my delivery is even better than yours.
Bob, delivery, nothing. I'm serious.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't affect the brain. Or fortunately, it doesn't affect the brain.
It primarily is a respiratory virus?
Yes. Its primary cause is pneumonia. Influenza is a disease with high fevers, bad muscle aches, and you try and cough your spleen out. It's miserable.
Right. And people die just because they can't get enough oxygen into their blood. The lungs fill up with too much fluid. Is that basically
it? Yeah. There's basically three ways flu kills you. A primary flu pneumonia, which is unfortunately unusual. Secondary infections, which is always a concern. And then if you have underlying medical problems like renal kidney failure or heart failure, it can push you over the edge and kill you that way. So it's multifaceted in its ability to take human life.
Although the early reports are that the people who have died of this flu were between 20 and 40 and healthy, so that, which is unusual. Usually it's the young and the old. And that would, is that a bad prognostic indicator for this virus?
If that's what they really died of, yeah. The problem is that I can tell, the data coming out of Mexico, is that these are people who have a flu-like illness. Now, how many of them actually had flu versus something else? But the bad thing about the 1919 pandemic is that it primarily killed young, healthy people very rapidly, and as well as the old and the young. And so if it if it recapitulates that, we could be in a lot of trouble.
Well, Mark, when at one point would you say to yourself, holy crap, what are you looking for? What would you wait for? Are there a few key things where you would, like, you know, just almost like crap in your pants, like, wow, where's, you know, where can I go hide?
Mostly it would be mortality rates. And, you know, outside of Mexico, there's been one death in about 100 people, which is about 1%. And the great pandemic of 1919 killed anywhere between 2 and 5% of people. So I'm already in a quasi-holy shit mode. The only question is going to be how infective it is and how quickly it can be contained by public health measures. And, but, you know, we're not going to really know until it hits, you know, lots and lots more people.
Let's talk real quick, just to give our listeners the latest on how to keep themselves from catching it in general.
It's two ways. Touch, so wash your hands well. If you touch something that has flu on it and then you touch your mouth, you inoculate yourself. And then the other is it's spread by coughing. So, I mean, you know the old thing about turn your head and cough? Well, they have you turn your head so you don't cough on the doctor. Coughing is a very efficient way. There's two really efficient ways to spread infections, cough and sex. So if someone coughs on you while having sex, you're dead.
Okay.
But, you know, stay away from coughing people if you can. It's hard where I work. But if you're coughing, wear a mask. And if you're with somebody who is coughing, they should be directing it into their hands, and you should be avoiding coughing if you can.
Do you think employers should take it seriously and send sick people home more than normal right now?
No, I don't know. I always follow the CDC recommendations. You know, part of the thing which is sort of interesting is that we just finished the flu season. It just was tapering off. We had documented 30,000 cases in the United States, which probably means we had a couple hundred thousand for real. It killed documented 55 kids. It probably killed 10, 15,000 adults if it's a slow year, which it was. So we just sort of got over a season where a large number of people got flu and died. So I don't know how different this is going to be from just regular flu, but if someone's coughing and they just got back from a trip to Mexico City, I'd send them home right away.
But the real problem is that, like, we go back to the 1918 pandemic. That killed millions of people just because it spread so quickly. Yeah, I mean, it was and researchers believe, from what I understand, that when viruses combine in a non-human host like this, you get like avian and human and swine viruses combining, it really only takes a couple of mutations before it can spread quickly through the human population. So really what we're just waiting to see is this strain, does it have those mutations or is it going to get them? And and it sounds like from what you're saying is we won't know until it's happening which way it's going to go.
Yeah, the great pandemic had like a 50% of people got the flu, which is very highly infectious. Mm-hmm. And usually it's not quite that infectious. So you had a combination of a virulent strain and a very infective strain in 1919. Whether this has both characteristics is too soon to tell just from the epidemiology. Not enough people have been infected. And hopefully we won't learn that ever.
Right. Now, in 1918, was that high infectivity also because they didn't know what they were doing at that time? Did they not put into place public health measures that we could do today, or really is it no way to really prevent something of that magnitude happening? And again, it's just a matter of what the virus is like.
Yeah, it's hard to say. When you read the historical things, people did shut down schools and wear masks and wash their hands and did all the stuff that they're recommending now, and it still spread like wildfire. But there was less understanding of pathogenesis of disease. So it's hard to compare 1919 to 2009.
Right. Yeah, but did they stop having sex, though? That's the main question.
and coughing during sex.
They stopped coughing.
I don't know the answer to
that area.
But if you hibernate, if you just totally limit and have no access to people, just kind of like hide out in your house with your family, it's not like, you know, these influenza victims are going to come shambling to your house and knock down, you know, doors and windows and infect you. And you could just isolate yourself and you're good to go, even if you have to do it for a month.
Yeah,
but Bob, most people don't have a month of food and water, though.
Bob, that's a very zombie-like scenario.
Absolutely.
But Bob, imagine what would happen to our infrastructure if everyone did that. I mean, no one's going to be showing up to the power plant and making sure that the electricity is still flowing. I mean,
that's my biggest concern.
Well, what the hell am I going to do about that?
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting question because, you know, this is, as a rule, societies slow down during big outbreaks and people don't do their normal activities. And if nothing else, even fear will really take our economy down the toilet even further.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's even if we do, if we have even a mild outbreak and people don't go to work, you know, I worry about people not going to my place of work when we don't have nurses and doctors showing up.
So, Mark, if somebody has the flu really bad, now one strong, swift blow to the head, and that's the way to deal with this, right?
That's zombies.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep confusing the two.
That's zombies. You go for the head. With right. influenza, you go for the lungs, and you give, if you catch it early, you give antivirals for the influenza.
Now, how effective would those antivirals be?
Well, most studies say they shorten your illness by 24 hours. I don't know of any more mortality studies. The avian flu cases that got treated, it didn't seem to affect the outcome that I've read.
That's Tamiflu. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Also Tamiflu. Okay.
So, well, my question was, Mark, what, in your opinion, what's the biggest myth being circulated and propagated by the media at large, and what should people be cautious of?
It's just more, from my perspective, is more a matter of tone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just sort of, I just read the book, It's Not News, It's FARC, which really puts a nice spin on what goes on. But the hysteria, not hysteria, but just the drama that you get on the newscasting is annoying. I keep thinking 30,000 people die in car accidents every year. You're probably at greater risk driving to your doctor's office for the Tamiflu than you are for flu right now. You know, I got some phone calls from some parents at my kid's school wondering if it was safe to go on a field trip on Cinco de Mayo. And I thought, well, you know, your biggest danger is the bus driver, not the influenza.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right now, 2 weeks from now, it could be a disaster. Or weeks from now, it's all gone. Unfortunately, you can't say one way or the other. I'm nervous, but people aren't good at relative risk.
So right now, you really don't have to do anything except maybe stock up on a little food. But other than that...
and practice those headshots. Right?
Other than that, it's really waiting and seeing what the experts say. What is the World Health Organization, the CDC? They're monitoring it quite closely. If it starts to show signs of being a particularly virulent strain, they will start to upgrade, I guess, the panic level and start to say things like limiting international travel, maybe shutting down schools. I mean, those are the early warnings we'll get that this is potentially a serious outbreak.
Yeah, but unfortunately, And, you know, I feel sorry for the people having to make these decisions because when they made those decisions in the swine flu in 76, it didn't pan out. And so, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. I'd rather they be a little overreactive than underreactive because I worry about, you know, when the big one does come, it's not going to be pleasant.
Talking about the 76 swine flu outbreak.
Yeah, what
first
was that?
Of all, what's the relationship of this current virus to the one in 76?
It's a different H1N1. I don't remember what the 76 strain
was. So same family, different strain?
Yeah. I think it was an H. I remember vaguely it was an H3N2, but I have to look that up.
Okay.
But it's a different...
Yeah, the designation, the H and N designation, I think that would be helpful.
Well, the H is for – there's two proteins on the cell wall of the outside of the influenza virus, a hemagglutinin and a neuraminidase. And there's a bunch of hemagglutinins and there's a bunch of neuraminidases depending on which strain and what animal it affects. And so it's the combination of those proteins that determine what the strain is and also what the antibodies to neutralize it are. So – you try and direct your antibodies and your vaccine against the hemagglutinins and the neuraminidase, which is the H and the N.
Okay.
And that's what determines the strain of the influenza. Were you guys alive when Gerald Ford was president?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, you bet.
Because, you know, all my residents weren't. And so I talk about Gerald Ford and they look at me like I'm this.
He invented the car, right?
Yeah.
I have the same thing, you know, because what I remember about that is the cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome that resulted from the vaccine. And whenever I bring that up to medical students, man, they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But in 76 in New Jersey, a military recruit died of a new strain of influenza. and it was a swine flu. And they did serologic testing to show that it had been spread in the camp. And so here, at a young, healthy guy who died of flu, they were worried that it was going to spread across the United States. So they vaccinated like 40 million people. It was sort of a neurologist employment act, because a lot of people came down with a neurologic complication, maybe. Not a lot, but more than usual. And they sort of backfired on the government, because the pandemic never panned out. Maybe this time it won't. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, but that brings up the topic of vaccine. So right now there's no vaccine for the current strain of swine flu that's out there. Yeah. What would it take to develop a vaccine, and what can it be done in time to prevent a pandemic if that's what's in the future?
What I've heard is going to take, I think, 3 months to get vaccine up and running.
That seems quick.
We'll get it right at the end. I mean, each dose of vaccine equals a chicken egg. So we got to come up with 300 million chicken eggs to make 300 million doses of vaccine. It's a major undertaking, because there's one chicken that provides all those eggs.
It takes a long time.
So it takes several months to get it geared up for vaccination.
And who, what company, or where are the most vaccines produced for influenza? It's not in the United States, is that correct?
Yeah, there's two companies, one in Europe and one here.
Great Britain, the one in Great Britain.
Let's do it.
Yeah, in fact, someone brought up the possibility, if there is kind of a panic about this, that it may result in a situation where Great Britain decides to hoard their vaccines and not ship them out to the United States, since it's going to be in limited supply. Which further brings up the topic of, why is it that our vaccine manufacturing is mainly overseas and so little of it is domestic, which does have something to do with the fact that being a vaccine manufacturer is a huge liability. It's something that a lot of companies would rather not do.
They can't make profit off of it, from what I understand.
Well, they don't lose money. They're not going to get a windfall probably from all this, but they make a tidy little sum, probably more than I'll make in a career.
Hey, Mark, isn't it true that chickens are particularly susceptible to bird flu?
Yeah.
So imagine we get a bird flu, it wipes out all the chickens. Whoops, no vaccines.
Yeah, and you know, they've been working for 20 years on genetic recombination to make the vaccine. I have no idea where that is. They haven't talked about any of the meetings lately. Hopefully one of these days they'll do it that way instead.
Couldn't we just use egg beaters?
Or snake
no,
eggs.
Actually, and unfortunately, the cholesterol is a very important part of the vaccine. Oh.
I have a couple of serious questions left. Do you think that these flus, these complex flus like the swine flu, come out of countries where people are in more close proximity with animals? Like, is that why they don't seem to come out of, like, say, the United States or England? Or
that's always the hypothesis. You have to have close contact of the three animals or whatever to get the recombination. So they tend to come out of places with small farms. When you look, often the first people to get swine, people who have close contact with swine, often get swine flu. That's not unknown, but it never spreads beyond the pig farmers. But probably because we have massive pig farms and they don't have the birds with them, and the humans don't pay that close of contact with them, that they don't have a lot of that occurring here.
And to be clear, despite what Paris Hilton said earlier, you don't get this from eating pork or from eating pig products.
No, and I had some great Cajun pork shanks this weekend, so I'd be really worried if that was the case.
So, Jay, you're still good with the bacon, Jay.
Yeah.
Heat kills viruses. Right.
Yeah.
But yet, despite all that, there are multiple countries that have banned the import into their countries of our pork and meat and beef products. Can you imagine that? Like Russia and a couple other countries.
Yep.
Like, sorry, we're not going to take it. What?
I know they banned our beef because of mad cow disease, but I hadn't heard anything about the pig flu.
Some groups were saying that we should change, you know, not call it swine flu, because so many people are thinking that it's, you know, it's related to consumption of pork, and it's not.
Hmm. So to expand on what Steve said real quick, because it's actually very funny. A reporter asked Paris Hilton what she thought of the swine flu.
She was worried about
it. Yeah. And her response was that she doesn't eat pork.
Right.
Well, she was also worried if she went into space that she'd be caught in a time warp and come back 100,000 years in the future.
Caught in a time warp. What is this, an 80s song?
She's not particularly. I think she's the science editor for the Huffington Post.
Uh-huh. You would think so. Speaking of horrific pseudoscience in the Huffington Post, the scares about the swine flu outbreak is creating a cottage industry of pseudoscience. So everyone is exploiting this to promote their version of woo. In fact, I read just today that 2% of spam emails are now hawking some kind of fake cure or protection against the swine flu. But in the HuffPo, Matthew Stein posted an article in which he recommends pretty much every pseudoscience you could imagine for treatment or for prevention of the swine flu, from colloidal silver, if you want to turn your skin silver, that's a good one, homeopathy, mm-hmm. echinacea, elderberry.
Isn't that
your
a joke?
Your mother eats elderberries.
Smelled elderberries.
Well, that's why, because she ate them, that's why.
Your mother is a hamster.
Just incredible. Just incredible.
Monty Python.
Hey, Mark, I listened to the last couple of shows you put out. The most recent one was about the Chinese medicine and how they're harvesting animals. Now, one complaint, you don't put out these shows fast enough for me.
All right.
I know that you were sick last time, but that's no excuse. I mean, what's up with your schedule? You got to get more of the Quackcast going because we got a lot of people that love it.
Yeah, unfortunately, work and family come first. Then all this other stuff I do gets done in the wee hours of the morning and the evening when I don't have to do.
You got your priorities all screwed up, Mark. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And it's even going to get worse because golf season is starting.
Oh, I was going to say, when do you play Warcraft?
Yeah, and I'll be out on the golf course with my boys all summer.
Now, the World Health Organization, they raised their pandemic alert status to phase 5. I believe that was done today, Wednesday the 29th. And that basically means that widespread human-to-human transmission. Now, there's only one number to go. Phase 6 is it, and that's full-scale pandemic. I wonder what is the transition between the two. At one point, did they say, yep, well, this is phase 6?
Yeah, but when you look at the experience of SARS in Canada, I think that has taught people to really lower the threshold for doing mm-hmm. stuff. Because SARS was a disaster for the cities that had it. And they shut those cities down for several months. And it was right. not good. And I think, you know, that's going to make people lower the threshold, hopefully, for doing all these things so they don't repeat worldwide what happened in Toronto. Yeah.
So, Mark, before we finish, you will be joining us in Las Vegas on July 9th for the Science-Based Medicine Conference.
Yeah, I'm looking forward
to it.
Yeah,
if they still hold it.
Yeah,
it should be over by then. Just don't inhale. That's all you got to do.
Mark, but you're...
Done and done.
I mean, look, I'm not trying to put down the Science-Based Medicine situation you guys have going, but, I mean, you're going to stay for TAM in the whole thing, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to stay for the whole thing.
Yeah, right, of course.
Because last year you promised and you blew us off.
Well, my colleague of 20 years retired, and I had to have his going away party.
All right.
I thought that was more important.
Again, what's your priorities, Mark? Come on now.
I know.
Wow, Mark.
I actually am trying to talk my dad into joining me. I think we'd have a blast together.
Is he also a doctor?
Yeah, he's a cardiologist.
Nice.
So when you're hanging around with your dad, you just kind of like shake each other's hands and go, doctor, 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 doctor.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you have to, if there's a time you have to get sick, being sick at TAM is not a bad thing. There's hundreds of doctors there.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it is that alcohol suppresses bacteria and viruses. So I'm going to use liberal amounts of alcohol in Vegas to keep my infections
away. If we time it right, they may shut down travel while we're in Las Vegas. We could be stuck there for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Darn.
Well, Mark, thanks again for joining us.
And on this very, very important and serious
I'd like
topic.
To quick disclaimer. All right, basically my disclaimer is we're not trying to make too much light of the thing. We know this is serious, but it's basically Mark is a funny guy. I can't help myself with him. That's, you know, I don't think the swine flu is funny. Paris Hilton is funny.
Now hopefully this will end up a false alarm.
Yes.
But if not this year, then next year. And if not next year, the one that follows.
Yeah, it's like an asteroid hitting. It's going to happen eventually.
Yeah, but more frequently than asteroids.
But even more frequently.
About every 100 years.
But every 100 years. Yeah, so we're due, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but if we make it to where we have nanotechnology, then we'll be fine.
Just gonna hang on.
Or if the nanotech goes awry, that's what will lead to the zombie apocalypse.
Absolutely.
That could do it.
All right.
God, you can't win either way.
Nano could pull it off.
Everyone should listen to Quackcast. It's a wonderful podcast. Definitely one of my favorites. Mark does a great job.
It's my favorite podcast. Absolutely.
And Mark contributes regularly to Science-Based Medicine. You could read his writings there. And if you come to TAM and the Science-Based Medicine Conference this July, you can meet him and the rest of us, so definitely come. Mark, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, Mark.
Good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. Then I challenge my expert panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's items?
Yes.
Yes,
dear. Oh, yeah.
Here we go. Scientists have developed the world's fastest camera that can capture images less than half a billionth of a second long. Item number two, South Korean scientists claim they have cloned several dogs that glow red in ultraviolet light. And item number three, a new DNA analysis suggests that Native Americans derive from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas. Bob, go first.
The world's fastest camera, half a billionth of a second. Is that all? I mean, I thought they were faster than that. Because there's lots of different ways for cameras to capture fleeting events like that. The fastest ones, you know, don't really even, you know, they're not, it's not like they're moving film to be exposed. It's they do it so many different ways now. A half a billionth of a second, to me, that's okay. That's not surprising at all. Let's see, cloning dogs that glow red and ultraviolet light. Well, I've heard of other animals being done this way. I think so the fact that they could do it with dogs, what are they doing? Some gene therapy? They're replacing some key genes that encode for that kind of effect. So it doesn't surprise me that they've also succeeded in doing that in dogs. Let's see, Native Americans derived from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas. Let's see. I'm gonna say that three is false. For some reason, just doesn't seem right. Doesn't seem correct that it was from successive immigrations rather than just one. So I'm gonna say that is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Well, the world's fastest camera. Scientists that have developed it. I think that is true. I heard that it made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. So. That would make it half a billionth of a second long. That's impressive. And I think that is plausible, I believe. And then the South Korean scientists claiming they've cloned several dogs to glow red in ultraviolet light. Why? I guess for identification? That does seem plausible. And then the DNA analysis suggesting Native Americans derive from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas. I'll just keep it short, keep it tight, and agree with Bob. Native Americans deriving from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
I am certainly leaning that way as well. I'm pretty sure that the puppies exist because I have heard of similar things, as Bob mentioned. They've done it with other animals. I think they did it with mice once by something to do with, I feel like, the gene that causes phosphorescent algae or something to light up. I don't know. I might be pulling that out of my butt. But makes sense. And glow-in-the-dark puppies must be adorable. So that's true. World's fastest camera, half a billionth of a second long. That is impressive. However, I do think it's true. So that just leaves the third one. I say, that DNA analysis suggests Native Americans derived from multiple successive immigrations is false.
Okay. Jay?
Okay. Scientists have developed the world's fastest camera that can capture images less than half a billionth of a second long. So that makes me think of two things. I mean, with a camera, it's shutter speed and the sensitivity of the film. And that's impressive if they can really do that. That's amazing that they could cycle a shutter that fast, and also that there could be film that is that sensitive to light. I'm sure that something is that sensitive. I don't know. It's pretty damn cool. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it. South Korean scientists claim they have cloned several dogs that glow red in ultraviolet light. Yeah, something is familiar about that. So I believe that one. And a new DNA analysis suggests that Native Americans derive from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas. All right, so to clarify that, meaning that multiple groups walked over, I guess, when the ocean was low enough, came to the Americas, and that happened on multiple occasions, and then those different groups all mixed their DNA over time. Is that what you're saying, Steve?
I believe it's self-explanatory.
All right.
Jay, I love when you go fishing for extra information. It's great.
Just asking for clarification, that's all. Yeah, I guess out of the three, that's the one that seems the fishiest to me, so I'm going to say that's the fake.
All right, so you're all in agreement, so let's take these in order. Number one, scientists have developed the world's fastest camera that can capture images less than half a billionth of a second long, and that one is science.
Science.
Impressive. Yeah. And Bob's right. This is not that much out of the blue. I mean, this is there are lots of techniques for capturing very brief events, but this one is being billed as the fastest to date, half a billionth of a second long. And the method used for getting such a short duration of time is not so much. It's obviously not in any kind of physical shutter. I mean, there's no way that anything could move that fast. But in the flash bulb, right? So using a laser pulse as the thing that illuminates what you're trying to see, and the key is in the control of the laser pulse. They're using a technology called serial time encoded amplified imaging, or STEAM, which depends upon carefully manipulating so-called super continuum laser pulses. One interesting thing is that they can capture over 6 million images in a second continuously. So it's not just one still image. They can actually do a series of up to 6 million of them over a course of a second, but each one is exposing only a half a billionth of a second duration.
That's quite a FPS.
Yeah, so they might be able to use this to... The one example they gave is this could be used to image, say, like the communication between neurons or something that happens on that kind of time scale. So very cool. Again, you know, like all these newly announced techniques and technologies, it remains to be seen how it will pan out. Let's go on to number two. South Korean scientists claim they have cloned several dogs that glow red in ultraviolet light. And that one is science.
Oh.
Yay, glow-in-the-dark puppies.
Wow, puppies.
I totally cool. missed the fact that this relates to South Koreans and cloning. That alone should have raised my skeptical alerts.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, and I checked this out a little bit. Of course, you never know. From my end, it's hard to tell if this is totally on the up and up. But there's a picture. I figured, okay, there's a picture of a glow-in-the-dark puppy, so...
Yeah, I don't have any doubt about this.
Yeah, actually. There's something. There's some evidence there.
This is actually a little odd. I'm seeing here that they... I mean, what are they actually claiming? What's the big achievement here? The fact that they glow in ultraviolet light, or that they cloned them, or both?
Yeah, that they were able to plant these genes. And the reason, Evan, why they did this was just this, they just wanted to use genes that would have some obvious effect that they could see. Right.
Yeah. Right. There's no ambiguity at all.
And that's a common marker. You know, you use a gene that conveys fluorescence or phosphorescence or whatever. Just something that you can follow where the gene goes because it has some obvious visual marker of its effect. That's why they did this. And it was really just to show that not only can they clone dogs, but they can genetically modify them in the process as well by inserting a gene. That was the whole point.
There you go.
Okay.
And it worked. Got pictures of dogs. In under ordinary light, they're beagles, so they're like parts black and parts white. The white parts look red in the dark under ultraviolet light.
Fascinating.
They were able to clone several of them, so it's not just one individual. Yeah, so this, you know, going to have mutant pets all over the place in a few years.
Seven-armed baboon. Right. Awesome.
So, Jay, if you could have some kind of mutant pet, what would it be?
Shark with laser beam?
There's so many animals I would love to have as a pet. It doesn't even have to be a mutant. So, like, you know, adding the mutant thing on there just, like, doubles how cool it would be. But I always thought having a lion as a pet would be amazing. So I suppose
born
if you could make my lion, you know, poop ice cream, that would be pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of? Give me a mutation. What are you talking about?
Ice cream. Really? Is there a gene somewhere?
Finally, they found the gene for pooping ice cream.
Yeah, but the ice cream tastes like crap.
Well, how about, Jay, a lion would be cool, but imagine if they could manipulate it so that it stays a cub even through adulthood. It always looks like a lion cub.
A bonsai cat. There's
a little neoteny going on.
Okay, I'm actually, you know, that's cool and that would be great, but no, not for me, because one of the coolest things about a lion is that its mass. I mean, its head is so gigantic and its feet are huge. Its paws are gigantic. And, there's something awesome. I just want to, like, bury my face in their fur. But
everything about the lion would be gigantic, including its crap and your food bills.
Well,
it's crap.
Look, man, you're asking me. All right, how about this? It would be willing to clean up all of its poop and pay the food and everything if it was super intelligent. That would be my mutant thing. I'd want the lion to be
super genius.
Super intelligent.
Well, you know, we have we scientists have done strange things to certain kinds of, like, say E. coli to make their waste product into something interesting, haven't they? Like, that seems like something researchers have looked into. So maybe you couldn't make it ice cream, but maybe you could, I don't know, make it some kind of, like, super energy source that doesn't smell.
Well, all of this means, as interesting as this is, a new DNA analysis suggests that Native Americans derived from multiple successive immigrations from Asia to the Americas is fiction.
Fiction.
It is bunk.
Bunk, yes. But it is based on a real news item.
Yep.
What DNA analysis has found is that Native Americans all come from a common stock, that they are not likely the interbreeding of or fusion of multiple different original people. You know, like, so where there weren't, like, Europeans at one point and Asians at another point mixing together to form modern day Native Americans, that their common ancestry goes back to a time probably before they actually crossed the Bering Strait. In fact, they probably derive from a population that existed in northern Canada, Alaska, Russia,
Inuit,
somewhere along the Bering Strait area. They probably lived there for a while and, you know, became a genetic isolated population, and that all Native Americans derived from them. Now, there may have been multiple migrations from that common pool. That's a question that DNA at this point has not answered, if it can. That's something that we're going to have to confirm with archaeological evidence. But they all derive from one common population that goes back to probably before they actually crossed the Bering Strait into North America. So DNA analysis is becoming so fast and cost-effective, and, you know, obviously the computer technology is available to crunch the numbers, that this kind of analysis is becoming much quicker. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this type of information coming out.
Gattaca.
Right.
I think this is the second or third week in a row.
No, second.
Steve.
No.
I know, Steve.
I got
Come
all
on.
You 2 weeks ago. You all won last week and this week. So I got to step it up a notch. Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
Well, first we should play it again for those of you who missed it. And here it is.
Evan, who was that noisy?
And that noisy was, in fact, the alleged sound of a Bigfoot scream.
Alleged Bigfoot.
I kid you not.
Is that from Harry and the Hendersons?
You're right.
How lame. I mean, Bigfoot would sound so kick-ass if he was real.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I always imagine him sounding like a Wookiee.
There are places you can go on the internet.
Let Bigfoot win.
They sound like all kinds of things, from a child screaming in the corner to a dog howling at the moon and anything else in between. Everyone's got or these Bigfoot proponents all have their own little recording of what a Bigfoot sounds like and so forth. And so I found the most interesting one I could find, and actually someone guessed correctly.
Yeah, there were multiple guesses correct, weren't there?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, there were.
Who got the first one?
Magnus M. from the board.
Magnus.
Well done, Magnus, if that is your real online name.
Your real well pseudonym. Done.
But on to more pressing things, such as... that was a good one. Such as this week's Who's That Noisy? Now, is everyone ready for this?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
All right, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Call of day the mitnadvei mada. מגן דוד אדום, אתם עושים עבודה משגעת, הלוואי ולא היינו בזמנים כאלה, אבל זהו, רציתי להגיד לכולם, עוד פעם, לכל עובדי מגן דוד אדום בכל הארץ, המון אהבה, ולסיום אני עומד לעשות משהו מצחיק עכשיו.
אוקיי, חברים, שימו לב.
עם הכפיות שלכם.
קלי, קלי, קלי.
Jay, we agreed no more accents.
Evan, you picked that one for me.
I love
so
that
wrong.
One. And I did kind
I love
of pick
how
that one for you.
I like how whoever it is, when he's pounding the table and you can hear the plates jump on the table.
that's almost worth playing again.
Thank you, Evan.
Okay, thanks, but Evan. I won't.
won't. Almost, but not.
Well, thank you, Evan. Jay,
you're welcome.
Do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. Good. I have a quote from Bernard M. Baruch. Anybody know who he is?
He's the Duke of Finuc, right?
No. Come on. Somebody's got to know who this guy is.
Dork.
What's the name again?
Bernard Mans Baruch. He was an advisor to Woodrow Wilson and FDR.
Ah.
On economic.
Oh, now I remember.
He was
an
economist. I know. I didn't know who he was either. And this this quote was submitted by Matthew Lee, and Baruch said, "Every man has a right to his opinion, but no man has a right to be wrong in his facts."
Smart guy.
BMB!
If I recall, an almost identical
Central Park
quote
in fall
is attributed to a former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who said that everyone has the right to their own opinion, but not their own facts. Did he come up with that on his own independently, or was he quoting Baruch and not giving attribution, I wonder? But do you guys recall that, Tip O'Neill saying that? Because I always thought that's a great quote.
Yeah, that is a good quote.
I remember Tipper Gore trying to put stickers on all the music that I like
that
to
I
listen to.
That I remember, too.
So, Steve, hit us up with the dates. When's TAM having?
All right, Science-Based Medicine Conference, July 9th.
That's Thursday.
And it's also that night is the reception for TAM 7, and which goes through Sunday the 12th.
Yeah, and I'll be there on Tuesday.
We're going to be there.
You're flying in Tuesday.
We'll be available to our listeners the whole time. We'll be doing interviews. We'll be putting
Not
on
the
a,
whole time.
Well, you know, we'll be putting on.
We get bathroom breaks.
Friday and Saturday morning, each for an hour during the breakfast hour. We'll be doing live shows.
Yep, a pair of live shows.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun and very educational.
And Bob will be there.
And Bob will be there, yeah. And we are having an SGU dinner, and as soon as we have the details, we will let you know. But that will be Friday night.
That'll
be Friday night.
Friday night. We're still nailing down the details. We'll have them probably the next week or two. And do you guys know what next week is?
Yes.
Yeah, Cinco de Mayo!
Which happens to fall on...
What? Why? What, Steve? What?
Is it the STU
birthday?
It's the
STU four-year anniversary next week.
Oh, yeah. Happy. I'm going to have cake.
4 years.
4 years.
How many episodes have we done now, guys?
I think we're a few episodes away from 200.
I think that's
wow.
That's pretty
good.
I
think good. It's Platinum Pokemon, no, actually, is the
I think it's the California
Einsteinium. Well, thank you for joining me again, everyone.
Thank
sure.
you, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week and our 4-year anniversary, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.